By the way, speaking of geek culture, which I end up speaking about half the time on Coast to Coast, went to go see the new movie Thor last night. Gosh, that's enjoyable. No big surprise. Kenneth Branagh is a great director, but you know, you can't always imagine how that's going to work. Somebody who's a Shakespearean director doing a superhero movie, and Thor just, I thought, was really enjoyable. And yes, there's a reason why, and I'm not going to spoil it, why Jeremy Renner makes a cameo appearance in this movie. So Academy Award winner for The Hurt Locker, Jeremy Renner makes a kind of a surprise appearance in Thor. I won't give it away. I won't give away the ending. But I'll say this, as always, for these Marvel superhero movies, wait it out through the credits. You've already been trained. There's always a little Easter egg waiting for you at the end of the credits, worth waiting for there too. So, Pure Energy, what would it be like to have it at our fingertips, as available as a matter-antimatter machine? Well, Scientific American has been following this story for years, and we're picking up where they left off tonight with one of the authors of one of their prominent articles on the subject in just a second. Mark Jacobs is an expert on this. He has quite the credentials, I'll just tell you right now. Stanford University professor Mark Jacobson has a background in civil engineering, economics. He has his master's in environmental engineering and in atmospheric science, University of California, LA, UCLA, where he has his PhD. Mark Jacobson is the author of many influential papers, and he has helped to write policy as a result of his research into the atmospheric effects of the energy we're using now and of the potential future of 100% renewable energy, which we will get to next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program there, and a perfect guest for us tonight on Coast to Coast. Good evening, Doctor.
Thank you, Ian.
All right, so pretty excited. You know, you must be when the president or anybody is spending time talking about renewable energy on a national platform, because that's a subject that kind of comes up. And then it drops off the public consciousness, and then oil prices go back up again, and everybody starts talking about renewable energy again, and then it drops off again. So you've been on it for a long time. You're an expert on this subject, and we kind of want to go in the direction of how much we will be able to do in the future and what is better now about the renewable energy plans that exist, that they might not just be, you know, something on a drawing board or a pipe dream somewhere. Where do we stand right now toward a goal of using 100% renewable energy as you see it?
Well, right now, if we look in the United States alone, there's a very small effort right now towards 100% renewable energy. I would say each state is a little bit different. I mean, California, for example, is fairly progressive. They have a goal of 33% renewable energy for electricity only within the next 20 years. And in other states, a lot of other states have goals for 20% renewable electricity. But of course, electricity is only part of the total. In fact, it's only about one-fifth of all the energy, or even less in many cases. And so we're very, very far from actually going to 100% renewable energy for all purposes, which is our plan. That we laid out in Scientific American and since then.
All right. Now, so define renewable energy, since some people might think, well, that might include something like nuclear power.
Yeah. So we define renewable energy as, well, not only has to be renewable, but it has to be clean, renewable energy and safe. And so we do not include nuclear power as renewable energy, even though it may be in some sense, well, it's not renewable because you use uranium, for example, that's a depletable substance, so there is a limited amount of nuclear energy, but that's actually not the reason we're not considering it. But we are considering things that, the ones we are considering, we did this based on a previous analysis where we actually did a review and ranked different proposed energy solutions to climate change and air pollution problems. And the ones that came out on top were wind energy, concentrated solar power, solar photovoltaics, geothermal power, tidal power, wave power, hydroelectric power. And the ones that we don't include, so those are the ones we include as clean renewable energy. And some of them have issues, like especially hydroelectric, but the hydroelectric will turn out to have extreme advantages in some respects that I can get into later.
And hydroelectric just means your good old-fashioned kind of water dam system?
Correct. There's two kinds, really. There's the big dams that you just have water gravitationally falling and through a generator to spins to generate electricity. And then there's also what's called run-of-the-river hydro, which is just a really small dam where the water just flows through a turbine and then goes right back to the river without really stopping at a dam.
Okay. So as you say, each state does it a little bit differently. Your goal, as stated in this article in Scientific American from a little ways back, was to get to 100% renewable energy. And when we saw gas prices spiking up to $5 a gallon, then it looked like there was no end in sight. A lot of people are going, oh, okay, what's next? And we can't, this is unsustainable what we're doing now. Our economy will tank if we do this. And then suddenly gas prices start going down again and people are going, well, where's my SUV? I'm feeling good about it. Everything's going to be fine after all. So what do you see as being some of the market forces that might drive these renewable energies in the future? What's going to get more people on board to want to increase the participation percentage higher than, say, 33%?
Well, right now, some of these electric power sources, I should say up front that they're, aside from the electric power sources, because electricity is one sector, the other components of this plan are in the transportation sector, which is going to electric vehicles powered by these clean renewable energy sources, and also, to some extent, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, which are really clean as well. But take more energy than the electric vehicles. And then you can imagine also for the other areas of the energy sectors are heating and cooling. So in homes, instead of using like a natural gas heater, use a air source heat pump, or instead of a gas water heater, use either electric water heater or an air source heat pump water heater. There's also solar water preheaters. These are all existing technologies. All the technologies we're looking at are existing, and that's part of the plan, that we can't bet on things that might be available in 20 years. We have to look at technologies that exist today.
And but again, so what are the market forces there that will get us there?
Well, so many of these technologies are commodities that are price efficient right now, and some of them are more expensive right now. So the ones that are cost effective right now are wind energy. For example, in the United States, for 4 years in a row, wind is the second largest new source of electric power after natural gas. And that's driven by market forces itself. So it's growing, and it is a huge share of the new market. But the problem is, it's not growing fast enough for us to completely replace our energy infrastructure, because we don't only need to power new energy. We need to get rid of old energy and replace that with new energy. So wind is inexpensive, hydroelectric's inexpensive, relatively, geothermal is, but solar is more expensive, and tidal wave are pretty high up there because they're very unknown commodities for the most part. So how do you get these less expensive? Well, the problem is that there are coal-fired power plants in the United States. There are many of the old ones are really cheap to run because they're grandfathered in under the Clean Air Act Amendment. In other words, they don't have to meet emission requirements that even new coal-fired power plants have to meet. And this was legislated in the 1970s, and because they thought they were going to go, these old plants would go out of business, not out of business, but would basically close down in the 70s, but they've stayed alive because they're so cheap to run. And so it requires some change of policies in the United States, and also other countries require changes of policies too. And some of those change of policies could be to either require certain emission controls, because that's what makes these other technologies cheap enough to run. Even natural gas, it has a lot of emissions associated with it, and nobody pays for those emissions. Nobody pays to pollute the air, which damages our health. And if natural gas and coal, if they're paying their true cost to society, then they would not be able to compete in the marketplace with the renewable energy systems.
And you say that because, and you've studied this, the health effects of some of these carbon-based fuel systems, you say, especially like over certain cities where there's like a dome effect of ill health that comes back that the taxpayer ends up picking up the tab for.
Yeah, let me give you an example. In the United States, due to all pollution sources, every year 50 to 100,000 people die prematurely from cardiovascular disease, respiratory illness, complications from asthma due to air pollution from fossil fuel combustion, either from vehicles or power plants or industrial emissions. And that 50 to 100,000, I mean, that's every year. And so you can imagine over 100 years, that's basically 5 to 10 million people have died in the last century just from air pollution from industries that nobody has paid those costs. And that's just the death. And then you can imagine the number of illnesses are on the order of 5 to 10 times higher than that. And so there's a lot of hospitalization associated with that. There's lost work days. There's higher insurance rates that result. And there's higher in medical care costs. There's lost school days. And this is not just me. I mean, this has been evaluated by many agencies. The EPA, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, has evaluated this. The Office of Management and Budget, the California Resources Board, South Coast Air Quality Management District, they've all looked at these health costs of air pollution, and it's essentially a huge hidden cost to taxpayers that we're basically paying because the industries won't pay these costs.
Okay, and so if they were paying all these costs, then these fuels wouldn't be cost effective.
Correct. Just to give an example, I mean, the cost of energy from a coal plant, it right now the direct cost is about 4 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour. That's about the same as a new natural gas. I mean, that's a new coal plant. New natural gas plant's about the same. A new wind turbine is about the same. But on top of that, for coal, you can attribute another about 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour for the health costs and environmental costs, which are associated with, for example, global warming. And so if you actually calculate the real cost of that fuel, of coal, for example, it's on the order of 11, or anywhere from 9 to 12 cents a kilowatt hour. And that would be much more expensive than wind energy. Now, it's still about the same maybe as solar energy, which costs on its own up to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. But you know, with wind energy, it would be much more.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Dr. Mark Jacobson about the hope for 100% renewable energy in the United States being completely free from any foreign oil by what year? What was your original hope?
Well, 2030 would be the goal to replace all new energy sources, and then 2050 to replace all existing energy sources.
Okay. Is there a country that is doing this better than we are?
There are a lot of places that are trying and doing this better than we are. The whole European Union has a better plan. I mean, they have a plan to go 80% clean renewable energy by 2050. And that's for all purposes. So that's essentially our plan, which is 100%, except they would go 80%.
Okay. And are they making strides in terms of being able to use wind, solar, water, hydraulic? Are they doing that concretely more than we are? Do they have more wind farms up yet?
Well, Germany in particular is definitely doing it more concretely as a percentage of the size of their country. They have a lot more, wind per capita. And even though the United States has a lot huger wind resource than Germany, and their solar per capita is much greater because they have what's called a feed-in tariff, which is a policy measure that really encourages the use of solar, even though they don't even have good sunshine in Germany. So they've done a lot more. Denmark, 20% of their entire electric power is from wind energy, And in the United States, we're on the order of 3%, 2 to 3%. Yeah.
If you were king, if you could, you know, bypassing our bicameral system, if you could just go ahead and implement something by presidential decree, and effectively sort of make over the United States as you see it, as a way that you think once you did it in rearview mirror, most Americans will look back and go, oh, well, that was great. I wish we had gotten behind that earlier. If you had that kind of power, you could just with one brush of your pen change the landscape here power wise in the United States. What would you do first? How many windmills are we talking about? How many dams are we talking about? What would it take to get us to be 100% renewable?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So it would take on a worldwide scale, I'll talk about the U.S. in 1 second, but on a worldwide scale, if we powered 50% of the entire world with wind energy, then we'd need 3.8 million 5-megawatt wind turbines. And
that doesn't seem like that many.
No, if we look at in World War II, the United States produced 330,000 airplanes in 5 years. And so we're talking about, factor of 10 greater wind turbines for the entire world to power half the world's energy. Now, and just to give you an idea of the spacing, let's take something, an example for the United States. Let's say we wanted to power the entire United States vehicle fleet with wind energy. And using electric vehicles, we would need between 70,000 and 143,000 5-megawatt wind turbines.
Now, that doesn't seem like that many.
No, it's not. So take an average of 100,000 wind turbines for simplicity. That would take the space on the ground for those turbines, because they're really just a pole in the ground, and then there's spacing in between. So there's a two separate number. It would only require 1 to 3 square kilometers of the United States surface area. 1 to 3 square kilometers to power the whole U.S. vehicle fleet. By far the smallest footprint of any energy technology.
Okay. Shut up. Do that number for me again, because that just sounds so... I was waiting for, like, you know, Eastern, Southern Dakota. You know, I was looking for something like some massive part of a state or something, but you're not saying that.
No, well, I said there are two numbers. There's the spacing and the footprint.
Okay. Right.
The footprint is the amount that you actually require touching the ground.
Okay.
And the spacing is the space in between turbines you need to prevent interference of one turbine with the other.
Right.
And so the footprint to power the entire U.S. vehicle fleet is 1 to 3 square kilometers.
Okay, that's nothing.
It is. It's nothing. This is why it's such. And just to give you a comparison, corn ethanol, to do the same thing, you would need 15% of the entire United States, including Alaska.
To be raising corn for fuel.
Fuel, yeah. 15% versus 1 to 3 square kilometers of footprint on the ground. Now, to be fair, wind, as I said, there's another number, which is the spacing. You need to account for the spacing you'd need between turbines, you need about half of 1% of the U.S., which is maybe one-third of South Dakota.
Okay. So, but if we put it all in South Dakota, that's what you would need. But you could even space that out over a large area, and it would have a minimal impact, say, over, you know, whatever states would be. Well, actually, you know what? I'll get back to that in just a second, because you're still king. OK, so I hereby still dub thee king. And if you could, then we'll talk with Dr. Mark Jacobson coming up just a moment from Stanford University. What else would it take? What other small impact would we see in our environment, in our economy, for such a huge return as going to 100% renewables? So we've talked a little bit about the turbine. How wide an area, and I mean that in terms of, like, you know, what are the best states for this? Are we going to be talking about, and what about the water? What about the water resources? What that would take, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So it's also a night of energy, and we're going to pick up this conversation with Dr. Mark Jacobson right where we left off before the break at the bottom of the hour. We're talking about 100% renewable energy. What would it take to get from point A to point B to 100% renewable? It's a much shorter distance than you could possibly imagine, and we're just getting started. It seemed like for the cost of what we would be spending on, say, one of these theaters of war, we could be funding this coming up in the next 5 to 10 years and getting a huge return back to our economy as well. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. All right, Stanford University professor Mark Jacobson, we're talking about both the environmental impact of not looking for more renewable energies, but also just how easy it would be to do this and how we could fairly cost-effectively get off of a greater dependence on foreign oil, so that when these oil prices spike up like they did earlier this week before they started to fall down again, we just wouldn't be so susceptible to the negative effects of that kind of profit taking going on, and that really what it is. I mean, these are very profitable years for the oil industry, partially because there's no other competition out there for those dollars. It's not enough to provide a market force that would make them have to be more competitive. The only reason why oil prices started going back down again is they got so high that people stopped driving so much, which drove down the prices. So if we look at that in a broader sense, if by not driving, we can drive down the price of a barrel of oil, imagine if we just kept driving the same amount, but we were getting our energy from a completely different source. Our economy could continue to expand while the oil price would continue to drop. And so that's what we were just talking about with some of the different renewable forms. Now, we were talking about windmill farms that we've been putting up in a very small part of the United States. It would not take much land for enough windmills to, say, power 50% of the government's vehicles. Right, Mark? Isn't that what you said?
Well, that was 100% of all U.S. vehicles for all purposes.
Of all U.S. vehicles, not just government.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I didn't write it down that way. And thank you. So then what states, what would be the best place to put these windmill farms? What would it take?
Well, so in the entire United States, about 15% of the entire United States on average has winds fast enough to be cost effective. To get cost-effective wind energy. And the places where the winds are fastest are in the Great Plains, of course, because it's flat and there are strong winds there, off the east coast of the U.S., which is really shallow water. In fact, you can power pretty much the entire United States just with offshore east coast wind. And it's shallow, and it's, you know, people aren't living offshore, so that's a nice place to actually have a lot of wind in the future. And then every state has its own resource. You know, there might not be so great of winds in, say, the south, although the southeast and coast is pretty good, and the southern coast, the winds are really good. But in California, we have a lot of wind along the whole west coast. We have a lot of wind. Texas has a huge amount of wind. You can pretty much find wind in every state.
And you mentioned Texas, and they're going through a drought right now, but that doesn't mean they don't have wind. They're just not getting any rain.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you a question, and again, we're going to move on to some of the other renewable sources here in just a second and how easy it would be to get there. But I've had this question for a while, so it's really stupid, and I am the dumbest guy I know, so just be patient with me. I'm a freshman in one of your classes, okay? Is that we have cars like the Prius, which are hybrid vehicles, which help in that when there is energy to run from the vehicle, from the power cells, you can do that. If you need to, you can tap in to a gas source, and that's what, you know, evens out the experience of being in one of these cars. And we've got some new cars coming up that are entirely electric that are supposed to be really good, like the Tesla that's getting rolled out. But why not have, would there be any point to having, as counterintuitive as it might seem, a petroleum-assisted windmill system so that it would be maybe enough at a minimum to keep those spinning. And then the return for that would be the wind would make them go that much faster, that you would have, you know, if you electrically powered some of these windmills, that would give it a little bit of a nudge and keep it consistent, and then the wind would come in on top of that and double or triple, quadruple the return on that.
So you're referring to the fact that we need to match power demand with a reliable supply. That's a common problem, and that's one issue with renewable, many of these renewable energy systems, including wind and solar, that they're what's called intermittent.
Right.
Wind doesn't always blow, sun doesn't always shine. Whereas the power demand is really variable, and you need to match it almost, you know, minute by minute, basically. But I should point out that, well, coal is what's called baseload, so it just provides a flat supply of energy. So it doesn't actually match power demand minute by minute, or and same with nuclear. They're both baseload power. And geothermal is also like that, too. They're flat. And wind is very variable. Solar is very variable. Now, hydroelectric and natural gas are what are called peaker types of energy sources, and that they can actually be used to fill in gaps and match power demand really well. So actually, in our scenario, the way we would match this power demand is not combining the wind with oil, but combining wind and solar together with hydroelectric and geothermal, in fact.
Okay, that makes more sense. That makes it like putting it like, to use geothermal, because I have a friend whose house is entirely geothermal. In fact, he has extra energy every month that he sells back from where he is. So if we put these windmills and we link them up to geothermal, we might be able to create, again, a greater return on the windmills that might make them more consistent.
Well, we actually did a study for California where we just looked at existing geothermal resources and existing hydroelectric. So we didn't actually increase the hydroelectric or geothermal, but we just took existing wind locations and solar locations and just increase their capacities to see if was it possible to actually match power demand minute by minute, hour by hour. And we found that by combining just these four renewables, because wind and solar are actually complementary, often when the wind is not blowing, the sun is shining. Because when the wind is not blowing, often it's because you have a high pressure system. And that means that when you have a high pressure system, that means air is descending, and so you don't have any clouds. That means you have a lot of sunlight. And conversely, when the sun is not shining, often it's windy, because generally when the sun is not shining, you generally have low pressure systems.
Right.
And those are in low pressure systems, as many of the Midwest know, are associated with strong winds and tornadoes. And things like
right,
that.
Right.
And so they're very complementary. And so by combining them in optimal proportions, wind and solar, and then using hydroelectric to fill in the gaps, and then then geothermal is just used as a baseload at the bottom to as a flat amount, you can actually, we found that you can match power demand with supply, or supply with demand, on 99.8% of the hours over 2 years with no other type of backup. And so it's really treating these as like one commodity rather than treating wind alone or solar alone,
right,
or hydro alone. You just treat them as a bundled commodity. And then that's how you optimize. And that's what we're lacking in the United States, is treating renewables as kind of a commodity. And also we're lacking a big national grid system, an organized grid system that would make this whole thing more efficient.
Kind of like the Justice League, where if Superman can't do it, theoretically Batman could, or, you know, I mean, like everybody, like each one of the powers would have their pluses and minuses, but together they're unstoppable.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, even in Europe, it's a little more organized because they have a plan for what's called a super grid that would link the solar and wind energy from the Sahara Desert back to Europe, and then also link hydroelectric and wind from Northern Europe down to the rest of Europe, and then have a huge transmission grid that expand their transmission grid so that all countries would participate. And it's really more beneficial to everybody to have cooperation and have an interconnected transmission grid that connects wind and solar resources and hydro resources from different locations together.
And so what would be the cost just to do the windmill technology that you suggested, just to put enough windmills up in the United States to generate the power that we were talking about before that could provide energy enough for 100% renewable energy for 100% of its applied use? What would that cost?
Well, there's two types of costs. There's the actual cost of the electricity, which is really what people care about. And that would be the same as we're paying right now.
No. What would it cost to build the actual?
Yeah, the capital. Well, that was,
yeah,
was
capital investment.
Which is,
yeah,
the capital cost. But I said put it in perspective because that number sounds like a big number, but it turns out, you know, that just gets amortized over time, and it ends up being the same as the, you know, the cost of electricity. So the, well, to do this on a worldwide scale, to do everything, to convert the entire world energy infrastructure into clean renewable energy infrastructure, and that's including electricity, transportation, and heating and cooling and things like that, about $100 trillion.
About $100 trillion.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about just in the, any idea just in the United States?
Well, so the United States is about a quarter of that, because we use, or sorry, not a quarter, it's about 18, I think about 18% of that, I think it's about the energy, the percent.
Right.
Energy consumption of the world. So, yeah, that's probably in the order of 18.
Okay, you're the math guy, so you got to help me out. So what would that mean, roughly, then, for, you know, how many trillion? We're talking about 18 trillion? I mean...
Well, keep in mind, again, that's money that would be spent anyway, because we have to put in every 30 years, we have to put in a new, you know, every existing power plant either gets refurbished or gets replaced. So that's just adding either new power, which would be done anyway, or replacing existing power, which would be done anyway.
Okay.
So this is not, that's just the capital cost that would occur. But again, that's, that money, once it gets invested, you start generating electricity and you sell the electricity, and the cost of electricity is really the relevant number, which is the, you know, basically the 4 to 6 or 7 cents a kilowatt hour.
Right.
And so that's why I say it's not going to cost any, the consumer, it's not going to cost any more than today. But the problem is, if we want to do this rapidly, we need a lot of capital up front to get things going, because we want to do it faster than just waiting till things retire on their own, for the most part. Although our plan does give us some leeway to go to 2050.
Well, so I'm just trying to get an idea for that. So I just started doing some quick math, and I know it seems like we would be able to, if we were spending, and at one point we were, $720 million a day on the war effort in the Middle East, $720 million each day.
Mm-hmm.
That it seems to me we'd get pretty close to that figure within, if we diverted that expenditure into this expenditure, we could do it in a year. We could seriously dent that price tag within 1 year.
Well, let's say it's $1 billion a day, it's close to 720 million, so that would be about 360 billion. So we'd be it would take a while longer.
Okay, sorry, I was missing a zero here as I was typing in my calculator. Okay, so then maybe over 10 years anyway, we would get there. The bottom line is, if we were putting the effort into something like that that was giving us a return, it would immediately start to kind of fund itself. Meanwhile, the argument is that one of the reasons why we have to stay in the Middle East is to keep the price of oil down and to keep it from falling into the hands of people who wish to control all of the world's oil and therefore ruin everybody else's economies.
Yeah, let me say something about the price of oil, because, you know, I drive an electric car. So I don't actually drive a gas car anymore, which I never have to fill it up. But the cost of electricity, so the cost of driving a car on electricity is 1/4 the cost of driving the car on gasoline. So it costs the equivalent of $1 a gallon to drive an electric car. Now, the cost of an electric car might be more expensive now, but the cost of the energy is much less if it's an electric car than a gasoline car. And the reason is because electricity is so much more efficient than internal combustion. it's in fact 4 to 5 times more efficient. So, for example, if you drive your car, every mile you drive your car, only 17% of the gasoline goes to moving your car. And the rest of the energy, the rest of the 83%, is just waste heat. And for electric car, about 80 to 86% of the energy goes to, of the electricity goes to moving your car, and only 20 to 14% is waste heat. So it's just much more efficient to drive an electric car, which is, which makes it, to me, it's and I think to a lot of people these days, it would be mindless not to move to electricity for cars.
Okay. Again, now you can link up to an article which helps explain some of this at coasttocoastam.com. Dr. Mark Jacobson, one of the leading professors, one of the leading academics in the country that's studying both the health effects of our existing power generating structure and the benefits of switching to 100% renewable, and how easily we could do it if we really put our mind to it. So we were talking about the windmills. Now let's move that into the idea of how many dams would we need, or how many of these free-flowing river hydroelectric plants that you mentioned before, how many of those would we need to help achieve 100% renewable status?
Well, actually, in our plan, we're assuming that 70% of all the hydroelectricity is already in place. In fact, I mean, hydroelectricity is a major source of electric power worldwide right now, and most of it's tapped out. So we would not actually increase it very much, only by, you know, adding maybe a couple hundred new large scale dams. So that would not take much area, because we anticipate that there would probably be resistance to much growth of hydroelectric as well.
Okay. But in terms of, and that's the same thing, are other countries doing hydroelectric better? Are we seeing that being done better in other places than it is here? Because I think we have a lot of these systems already in place, but what about the rest of the world? Are we seeing other people who are being better role models on this?
Well, in Brazil, almost all their electricity is hydroelectric. It's at the Amazon River. And so that's probably the largest percent electricity from hydroelectric, and certainly in Norway and Sweden, there's a lot of hydroelectricity. Canada has a lot as well. But I think, the United States has a significant amount. Much of the U.S. electricity, or a good percent, is hydroelectric right now. So I think in each place there can be incremental increases where necessary. But the main benefit of the hydroelectric, as I mentioned, is filling in the gap. When wind is not blowing, the sun is not shining. So that's really where we'd advocate increasing it, is where you need the gaps to be filled the most.
Okay.
To make the rest of the system work best.
And then you mentioned geothermal earlier, and as I understand it, not every part of the country can do geothermal.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Which is too bad, because, like I said, a friend of mine here is 100% done with his energy needs from geothermal, and then ends up selling back much of that to the local power company too. Which, you know, it's terrific if you can do it, but not every part of the country would provide for that. All right. So we're talking about going 100% renewable. Now the question that has to arise is, what kind of opposition does this industry meet from other industries that want to keep it just the way it is? So who's helping and who's getting in the way of getting our country to 100% renewable resources? And we talk about getting all the oil we need from the United States and never having to get it from foreign sources. That's fine. What if we got all the energy we need without having to drill anywhere? We just had it. We just took it from the environment. And by the way, does this mean, too, that Dr. Mark Jacobson hates birds? We run into that every time we talk about windmills, and we'll get back to that, too, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.